Welcome to episode 174 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and Les Klinger and I are speaking to Hank Philippi Ryan about her new standalone mystery, The Murder List. Welcome, Hank and Les.
Thank you.
Good to be back on the show, Nancy. I've been leaving you to steer the ship by yourself, and you've been doing an amazing job.
Well, you're very kind to say that, but it's always better when you're on board. Captain, my captain.
Oh, thank you. I can't believe you're at 100, that we are at 172 episodes.
Right, with almost 70,000 downloads. So we're
Great.
I think that's like the champagne anniversary or the bestseller anniversary or something like that, how they have gold and silver. But I think 172 and 70,000, that's got to be pretty, that's amazing.
Well, thank you very much. But talking about amazing, Hank, there are so many things to congratulate you for, your Emmys and the publication of The Murder List. And so I have one question, because Hank is married to an attorney, and Les is an attorney. And my only attorney association is I am the mother of an attorney. So are all attorneys round the bend? Is that fair assessment?
Well, do you think anybody's listening to us? Anybody who's an attorney is listening to us? You know, what do you... Well, clearly Les is round the bend. There's no question
about that.
And we rely on it. So we rely on it so thoroughly. I think that the wonderful, fascinating, intriguing, brilliant part about attorneys, and you know, my husband Jonathan is fabulous and diligent and devoted and such a good guy in every way. I think they are an incredible combination of researchers, investigative reporters, and storytellers, and they have to play by a set of rules. But the rules are complicated, and there are millions of them. And it's a question of finding your story and then figuring out what rules you're going to use to tell that story, to convince a jury or a judge that it is the true, true story. And depending on how good a researcher you are and how nimble you are, how passionate you are, and how good a storyteller you are, and how much you want to win, the question for lawyers is, how far will you go to win that case? And Les, I mean, you know this, and I know this from living with Jonathan for 24 years. I mean, each case is just this life or death, high stakes,
yes,
not only for the client, but for the lawyer, because it really is all about winning. So that can, you know, that can make you passionate. It can make you a little bit obsessed, or it can make you completely obsessed about your case. And wow, for crime fiction authors, that is great fodder, because in the core of it is someone's, I mean, truly their life is at stake. And you, the storyteller, have that life in your hands. So I'm drawn to that. So, I mean, I tell my husband constantly, I love your job. I completely love your job. I love everything you talk about. I love everything you think about. And I love hearing how you think. And that's sort of the essence of The Murder List too.
And I think we should mention really quickly, the title of your new book is The Murder List. Explain what The Murder List is, because it might be something surprising to people who haven't seen the book yet.
Well, I love this. And, you know, like all Hank titles, crossing fingers, it means a lot of things. It means several things at least. But in the first meaning of The Murder List is The Murder List is a real thing. My husband is on it, which is sort of the colloquial term for the list of lawyers who are experienced enough and benevolent enough, because they get a lower pay rate, to represent murder defendants who cannot afford to pay for a lawyer. So because the stakes are so high, and because everyone deserves the best possible representation, murder list lawyers are asked to represent people who whose lives are at stake, and who need to have an attorney with as much savvy and brilliance and determination and power as the powerful prosecutor has. The Commonwealth, the state, brings a lot of power to a trial, and especially to a murder case, and it's only fair to have an equal, an equally qualified and an equally brilliant attorney handling that case. So the murder list on the first level is those lawyers who are qualified to handle essentially hopeless cases in incredibly difficult circumstances, even though they have no money to pay for it. So the state pays these lawyers an incredibly cut rate to do it. So you have to be incredibly passionate to accept these cases and devoted to justice. I mean, the prosecutor is sort of protecting the public, and the defense attorney is sort of protecting the one individual little guy. And that's the battle that lawsuits, that murder cases like that set up.
Interesting system. We don't have this in California. All you have in California are public defenders. And people who take on cases pro bono. They don't get paid by the state to defend these cases. But it's an interesting idea.
It is, because, you know, the idea of a public defender, if someone has shoplifted, I mean, you can have an inexperienced lawyer who knows what they're doing, and they have a tough, tough job, and you have to really admire people who do that kind of work, because that is the trenches.
They're so overworked. Large caseloads, typically.
Exactly. But when you have the highest of stakes, I mean, life in prison without the possibility of parole, a case like that, since Mass doesn't have the death penalty, you need, it's only fair, and the state sees, the Commonwealth sees that it's only fair to have the best possible representation. And of course, you know, the murder list may also mean a list of people who may be murdered. One of the main characters in the book calls the murder list his list of clients that he handles, his list of murder clients that he handles. But obviously, looming over all of it is the list of people who have been murdered, and why are they on this list?
And who killed them? Which I found, you know, as you go through this book, and one of the things that's intrigued me about this story, And I believe you've done this before, is you've kind of tell the story on two tracks. You have the present and the past. And I'm always curious with writers, did you write this in a linear fashion, or did you write this sort of the story taking place in the present day and then in the past, or in the past and in the present day? How did you do this?
You know, I'm a television reporter. I've been a television reporter for 43 years, which is really pretty crazy when you think about it.
You were 3 years old, yes.
Exactly, 100%. And I'm still on the air at Channel 7 in Boston. And the way that you do an investigative story is you take a lot of facts and a big, complicated story that has an incredible amount of background and an incredible amount of possibilities and an incredible amount of combinations, and you put the story together in a way that's compelling and entertaining and engaging and enlightening and new and riveting, right? That's what an investigative story is. And that's what crime fiction is as well. It's exactly the same thing. So I have learned to take a lot of really complicated stuff and make it into entertaining and logical and clear. So I wrote this book from page one to page whatever the end is, straight through. When it was time for us to go back to 6 years before, the rhythm of writing told me now it's time to give some background. But it's not background, and that's what I want to sort of make clear. It's not background and it's not backstory. The way this book is written is that what took place in the past is now for the past, if you know what I mean. It takes place in the past, but now. So the characters in the past, of course, don't know what's going to happen in the future. It's not them reflecting or looking back or musing or internal dialogue or any internal thought or anything like that. It is the now of the past. So they don't know what their future holds. The cool part to me, and the sort of dramatic irony that can happen as a result of that, is that the reader begins to understand why people do the things they do, even though the characters may not see it that way, the reader does. So there are times when the reader knows more than the character does. And that's what I think is the cool part. So when you read the book, the way, you know, Nancy, the way you describe it, it's difficult to describe, but it's easy to read. It completely makes sense when you read it. And it's almost as if the reader has some secrets, that they know things that the characters don't know. And that's what I really love about that. But that's the world's longest answer to the world's best question. I wrote it all in a row. I wrote it from beginning to end.
Well, I did find... in that portion of the book where we'll call, for a better word, the setup to the story, I found some really lovely foreshadowing of what was going to happen. And something that you actually, I didn't see until I reread the book before this interview, because I always like to have the characters fresh in my mind and that sort of thing. But it was so subtly done and so intricately woven, and you make a point that I hadn't even thought of your experience, your Emmy award-winning experience as an investigative reporter on television, that the story, you can see the story as you read it. It has a tremendous visual element. You can see the winter.
That's my favorite thing to hear. Thank you. You know, when people say to me, oh, I could just see that, that is the highest praise. You know, when you talk about the movie in your mind of the book, if you can see it like that, that's fantastic. And the thing I love when you talk about this foreshadowing, and I'm thrilled that you read it again, because it's a different book the second time, isn't it?
Yes.
Which I love. But I didn't put in the foreshadowing because I didn't know what was going to happen. So I don't have an outline, and I don't know the end, and I don't know who the good guys are, and I don't know who the bad guys are, and I don't know who gets killed, and I don't know who the murderers are. I don't know. So as I said, I'm writing it as the story goes. Sometimes there are things in there that turn out to be foreshadowing. And that's, you know, Sue Grafton used to call that the magic, that you put things in a book and you think, huh, that's interesting. I wonder why I put that. And then later you see why. You know, later you think, oh, that's why he was there, or that's what he was really thinking, or that's why she did that. Oh, I wondered why that was in the book. It's just, and, you know, knock on wood, it happens every time that when you finish, you see what you meant to write and why you wrote those things. But it's not conscious foreshadowing. I mean, you know, you're writers, you understand this. It's just how the story is. And because the story is the truth of itself, people do things that mean something that even I, the writer, didn't know at the time.
If you got it right, yeah.
Oh, well.
Let's talk about how you got here, Hank. I mean, you got corrupted at some point. You were an honest journalist. You were an honest journalist for a whole bunch of years. And then sometime in the 2000s, you said, I'd like to make stuff up.
Yeah, that is interesting because I loved mysteries ever since I was a little girl. You know this. And I devoured every Sherlock Holmes. I mean, my parents lost me for a month. I was up in the hayloft of the barn behind our house reading that big orange volume of every Sherlock Holmes short story and novella. I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I learned about the rhythm and the music of Conan Doyle's writing and how they have a special feel. And then I went on to the Golden Age authors, and I just devoured those books. And I knew I sort of wanted to be a mystery author or a detective. And I kind of thought maybe it would be fun to be the book rather than write the book. So I became an investigative reporter, long story. But one day, as you say, in the 2000s, I was sitting at my computer at Channel 7, and I opened a spam email by mistake. And I was deleting emails, and I opened this one by mistake, and it had the headline, "A New Refinancing Deal for You." And when I opened it, it was lines from what looked like a Shakespearean era play. I was a Shakespeare major to my parents' chagrin, but I didn't recognize this. But it was obviously dialogue from that era. And I thought, why would someone put dialogue from a play, Shakespearean era play, in a spam email about a new refinancing deal? Why would you do that? Because everybody's going to open this and everyone's going to be baffled and no one's going to understand why you would do this. And my brain said to me, maybe it's a secret code. And I thought, oh my gosh, a book, my book, my book, the secret messages in computer spam. How could you do that? And what would be the point? And how would you do it? And what would be the stakes? And who would get killed? Because of course I was going to write a murder mystery. And I went home. This was 2000, I think, 4-ish. I went home and I said to my husband, I've got a great idea for a mystery. I'm going to write a mystery. And Jonathan says, that's great, sweetheart. he says, do you know how to write a mystery? And I'm like, how hard can it be? You know, I thought, I've read a million of these. I know how to write them. And it was only that bizarre and ridiculous naivete that got me to do it. Because if I had known how hard it was, I would have said, well, that's silly. You know, I can't possibly do that. That's way too hard. But I just sat down at my desk and I just, you know, I thought to myself, I'm a natural, I'm going to do this. And it wasn't like that at all, but it was rigorous and incredibly difficult and took a while, long time. But that book was Prime Time, the first book I've ever written, Prime Time, and it won the Agatha for Best First Novel. And that was the beginning of all this, so crazy, because of a random email that I just happened to randomly open at the time that my brain latched onto it and said, this is a good story. But I have to make it up. And as you said, Les, the interesting part was that I knew I could tell a story. I've been telling stories for 30 years at that point. But I did wonder whether my brain would allow myself to make stuff up. That was a Rubicon to cross, because I hadn't really ever made anything up. You know, that's just not how my imagination worked, to take real stories and make them entertaining and put them together in ways that had never been put together before, but only with facts, not just, whoa, this can be anything I want it to be. And that was an interesting process.
I think it's hard. I think it's hard to make stuff up.
Absolutely. Believe me, I'm in awe of fiction writers. I have a draft of a very bad novel on my computer, which was my sort of effort. And wow, it was tons more work than the nonfiction stuff that I write. The other thing, by the way, my wife keeps saying to me, why don't you write your own book as opposed to writing annotations or editing anthologies and things like that? And I keep saying, why would I want to be in competition with all those other writers? I mean, the fiction world is extremely difficult to succeed in. And of course, Hank, you are one of the rare exceptions to that. It's hard to get media attention. It's hard to get reviews. And there's a lot of other good writers. And the nonfiction world is just so much easier.
Well, you know, I don't think the nonfiction world is easier.
I'm gonna take exception to that too.
you can't make a mistake. It's a huge responsibility. You have to do a tremendous amount of research. You have to bring a new understanding to a thing that people know about. So why should people read that? I mean, I would love to do a true crime book. I would love to, but it is an incredibly intimidating thing to think about. So I think writing is hard. You know, to do a good job as a writer, as an author, is incredibly difficult because you want it to be compelling and riveting and perfect and interesting and better than anybody else's that has ever written on the entire planet. And then you want people to love it and you want people to take it home and tell people about it. And that is a very high bar, whether it's nonfiction or fiction.
And you have gotten yourself, but you sort of, I was about to say you got yourself trapped with some series, but you've worked your way out of it. The publishers, of course, want you to write. I mean, I love the publisher's attitude, which is, you know, we want you to write another book just like your last one, except different.
Yeah, that's true. And it is perfectly true. But, you know, that's a cut. When you think about it that way, that's ridiculous. But when you think about it, that there is a Hank book. There is a book that's like a Hank book. And it's going to be smart, and it's going to be contemporary and timely. It's going to be surprising. It's going to be a Trojan horse book. And that's sort of how I look at The Murder List and my first standalone, Trust Me. Sort of a Trojan horse book that you think you're reading one thing, but you're really... But actually, it turns out to be something else. That's what I love to do. You know, in The Murder List, it's a triangle. It's a triangle of Rachel North, Jack Kirkland, Martha Gardner. Jack Kirkland is a brilliant, powerful, benevolent, devoted defense attorney. And Martha Gardner is an incredibly powerful, driven, obsessed prosecutor. And they both think they're fighting for the legal and moral soul of Rachel North, a law student. That's what they think they're doing. And that's what the book begins to be. But then the reader begins to realize that this twisty triangle is another story entirely. And as that evolved, as I wrote it, you know, it's really exciting to see that you can write a book that's the same as what you wrote before, because it feels like a Hank book, but different because completely different characters, completely different conflict, and a completely different set of surprises. So that's exactly, as you say, that's the challenge of it, to write.
How do you juggle things? I mean, you're still working as a reporter, as you said. So how do you make the writing work for you? How do you get it into your day?
Yeah, it's just a question of really being organized. It's realizing, I don't know if this is A, B, or C, but it's one, realizing that everything is not going to get done, that everything in the world is not going to get done. You know, maybe the towels in my linen closet are not perfectly folded. Maybe I don't actually cook dinner as much as I used to. Maybe there's a lot of carryout salmon from Whole Foods, and maybe there's a very patient husband when it comes to that. We our vacations, you know, we rarely go on vacations. We used to go to these things called movies and movie theaters. We don't really do that. And I work all the time. So it's, you know, we don't have any living plants, you know, inside house plants, and, you know, we don't have any pets, sadly, and the grandkids live in Brooklyn, and, you know, so we, you know, Jonathan has his passion, and I have mine, and it all works out beautifully, but I work all the time is the real answer.
Of course, you do have the ducks, which you share on Facebook, and that they are maybe not pets, but...
Well, I think we're their pets. I mean, let me just say very quickly that reasons that this kind of works, if it works, is that I don't multitask. I do one thing and I just do that. And then I do the next thing and I just do that. Because I don't think multitasking is successful. I think you can't really do anything 100% perfectly if you multitask. So the ducks, as Nancy was saying, we live in suburban right outside of Boston, and we have an old house, 1894 house, that is impossible to air condition, which is like so crazy these days. And in the back, there's a swimming pool, an in-ground swimming pool that's been there for, gosh, I don't know, since the 50s. And every year on March 14th or so, the wild mallards come. The pool is covered with a pool cover, so it looks like a pond. And the ducks come. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes that they've come for 20-some years. Craig Johnson was the one who said, like, sweetheart, they're not the same ducks. I have to tell you. But, okay, Craig always knows. But
Craig always knows.
He does. You know, I rely on him for this kind of stuff. So they know, they come to the door when we come out because they know we're going to feed them. We name them. They are famous on Facebook. You're absolutely right. So We're their pets, I think. They have certainly trained us to feed them.
Well, just to get back to the story, to get back to the murder list, and this is actually my last official question. After reading Rachel's story and reading it twice, I have two questions. Is starting over possible? And B, if it's possible, is it a good idea?
Well, I think, you know, I think we all want to be the good. And that was the thing that I wanted to make sure that people realize about the murder list, is that the prosecutor thinks they're the good guy and the defense attorney thinks they're the good guy. How can there be two good guys, right? Good is just situational, depending on what you want. So if you take someone who wants something and they think they're going after it for the right reason, does that make them good? Does that make them good? What is good? What does that even mean? And when people's lives are at stake and careers and futures are at stake because of someone thinking they're doing good, that's what I was trying to explore in this, because everybody can't be the good guy, but everybody thinks they are. You know, how can that be? So can you take something that happened in the past and start over and jettison that baggage and be someone else? That's what I'm thinking about in this. How far away can you push your history? How much can you carapace over something that's happened in your life as a defense attorney, as a prosecutor, as a law student? You know, we all have these pasts and we're all trying to be better, but that doesn't mean that history goes away. Is that what you mean? What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's actually, first of all, I love the word carapace, so thank you for using that. No, that was my question. You know, and I'm thinking specifically of Rachel, and it brings me back to sort of another thing I was thinking about, how, you know, politics, law, and justice make this strange brew, because before she was a law student, Rachel was in a political aide to a state senator.
And think about this. I mean, think about it from the standpoint of power. That's what this is all about. It's about power and winning. And when you're in politics, and this is not a political thriller by any means at all, but you want to win. You want to be the one who's right. And when you get out and it's all about storytelling. It's all about convincing. It's all about being on the right side. But the side we choose is the side we think is the right side. And what if it isn't? Whether it's
important. And what if we go too far? This is also the Hank, you know that I've been involved with the innocence movement and done a book on wrongful convictions. And I think that's exactly the problem in some of those cases, is prosecutors who thought they were on the right side, or police officers who thought they were on the right side and really went too far.
And it's interesting because at some level, you know, I remember when I was writing this book, and I wrote something about the prosecutor, the defense attorney and the prosecutor, you know, are completely at odds with each other professionally and personally. You know, neither of them likes to lose, and they're sort of each other's bête noire in this. And, you know, my editor said to me, you know, and some people think the prosecutors are the good guys. You know, don't forget that. And I thought, oh yeah, I guess I, you know, that because we sort of, in all the stories of the Innocence Project and the unlawful convictions and the problems with innocent people being convicted, that is top of mind, especially to someone whose husband is a criminal defense attorney and who works as I do as an investigative reporter. My job is to illustrate when something doesn't work. So this is exactly what this book is about, because prosecutors should be good guys and police should be good guys and defense attorneys should be good guys. So how do we get to good in justice, good in the world of justice? How is justice done? And how do we make good and justice be the same thing? And it just isn't always. Sometimes it's just a result. You know, sometimes it's just a verdict. But there's way more behind every verdict than we, you know, than someone saying guilty or not guilty.
Thoughtful.
Thoughtful. But on another note, before we started recording, Hank said that she had just was working on another novel, and I loved how you put it, that you're near the end, and I'll hopefully you can remember exactly what you said and take it up from there. And Les had a great rejoinder.
Well, it was funny because I'm in the midst of doing my next book, and so my book, trust me, just came out in paperback. So people are talking about that all the time, and it's wonderful. I'm so thrilled that it's finally out in paperback. And then The Murder List is coming out August the 20th, so I'm thrilled and my head is full of that. But then I'm also writing my next book, which is due in a month. And I'm on word number, I'm looking at my words per day chart right now. I'm on word number 97,875. And I have like 3 weeks to go. And pretty soon, when I get back to writing this afternoon, I will come closer to knowing who did it and what the story is about. Because I never know what's going to happen. You know, I don't have an outline. I don't know what's going to happen until I write the next line or the next paragraph or the next scene, and I'm always surprised. So I can't wait to see what the surprise ending will be, but I certainly don't know it yet. I don't know who the good guys are, and I don't know who the bad guys are, and we'll see.
Go back and change it all.
I go back and see, you know, because then when I'm finished with this first draft, which, you know, I just keep going, keep going, keep going. I just tell myself, right, advance the story, just keep going. It's arithmetic, you know, if you do 1,000 words a day, it's going to be done,
right,
eventually. Then I'll finally go back to revise and see the story that I meant to write. That's what happened with The Murder List. When I figured out what really happened in The Murder List, I gasped. I sat here with, you know, my chin in my hands, and I thought, can that really be true? Is that what I wrote? And I was so surprised. So my new book is called The First to Lie, the new book, next year's. And I can't wait to find out what that's about. You'd think I'd know it by now, 97,000 words in, but I'll get there.
I sympathize with what you said about trust me, too. I've had that happen many times where people want to talk to you about that book, and you're like, oh, really? Oh, yeah, that book. I forgot about that. I'm two books later already.
Exactly. I mean, our brains have to juggle. Talk about juggling. Our brains have to juggle so much. But that's, you know, what a lovely first world problem that is.
You yes,
know, to, you know, I count my blessings every day about this and how this has turned out and the world I get to be in.
Everybody will want to know, are you going to go back to either of your series?
There is a Jane Ryland book already under contract. So everybody sort of expects that book is definitely coming. It has a title and everything. But there is another standalone after The First to Lie. There's another standalone after that too. So we'll just have to see, what order.
Do you find that the publishers are, pushing you that they don't want the standalones?
That they don't want the standalone?
Right, that they want more of the series and
no,
less.
No. They're very enthusiastic about the standalones. My publisher, Forge, awesome in every way and has encouraged me with the standalones and has had a lot of success with that. So they're thrilled. I think they're.
Well, that's great.
100% happy.
Because I know one of our mutual friends is having a lot of difficulty with sort of saying to them, look, I don't want to write another series book right now. I want to do a standalone.
Well, you know, that's a fun argument, I guess. You know, if somebody wants you to do something and that's because it's successful and your brain is churning ahead to something else, it's kind of a sort of a good problem to have, I guess.
It is.
Your brain is so happy and full and ready to go, but on the other hand, something else that you do is so successful. I mean, who would have thought 12 years ago or whenever that we'd all be talking about this? You know, how great is that? It's completely wonderful. And guest of honor, one of the guests of honor at this year's VoucherCon, that's pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, it's been fun. Someone said to me once, "What are you going to do when you get off the merry-go-round?" And I'm like, "Get off! I'm loving this."
Exactly.
And so are your fans. I mean, it's I love your series, and I love the standalones even more because I think a series is sort of like catching up with an old friend, and a standalone is a new adventure.
Well, it's interesting because a series, you know, the key of a series is that the audience, the readers know that the main character is not going to die, right? Jane Ryland is going to come back for book 8 or whatever it is. So the suspense in a series has to come from some other construct, some other thing that happens, some other adventure that happens to this character who you love. But the thrill of a series book is not the fear of that the main character is going to meet their demise. They're just not going to. So that's a puzzle piece. That's a weapon, and that's a piece of ammunition that the author doesn't have. But in a standalone, you know, when I wrote Trust Me, I thought, wow, you know, anyone could live. Anyone can die. Anybody can be good. Anybody can be bad. Anything can happen. It's all on the table. And the reader has no expectation of what will happen in a book. You know, they just know they're on this ride, and the author has the power to do anything they want, and prepare to be surprised because you don't have to save anyone. You know, anyone could die. And that, you know, I just sort of stood up and applauded when I realized that. I thought, well, bring this on. You know, I'm going to try this. And it was a huge challenge, but I really enjoy being able to think, I could do anything. You know, that's a wonderful power.
Well, yes. You can. You can do anything. I'm completely convinced of that. I think we should thank you for your time, for joining us.
This has just been great. I love talking about The Murder List. I'm very excited about it. I'm very thrilled about it. You know, at this time, just before it comes out, sort of anything can happen. I can't wait to hear what people think about it. You know, so come tell me. Find me on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Let me know what you think about it. I think it might be controversial. So.